Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segreto, and this is Franchise Today. Happy Veterans Day to all who served our country or are currently serving our country. Thank you. Your sacrifices certainly mean a great deal to me and to many others. The freedoms we take for granted every day are ours because of each and every one of you that has served in the military. Something as simple as having a radio show like Franchise Today and being able to speak our minds would not be possible if it weren't for the freedom all of you have fought for. Again, thank you. And here's something. I challenge all our listeners to do something to do in honor of Veterans Day, actually in honor of all our military personnel. The next time you see someone in a military uniform, thank them. That's right. Just thank them for their service. Sure, you'll feel better, but they'll feel great and certainly appreciated. Well, I can't believe 2010 is racing by as fast as it has. We're already in the middle of the month with only 7 weeks to go until the new year. Imagine 2011. It seems like we were just dealing with Y2K issues. It was actually something I admired about that whole Y2K situation. It seemed like with a definitive date of January 1, 2000, many businesses actually had a plan in place. Sure, they didn't need to follow through, but the threat, the challenge, was perceived as being so real that strategies were developed and plans were put into action, which makes me wonder. Do businesses only follow through when there's a threat or a challenge on the horizon? With that in mind, I'd like to ask how your plans played out for 2010. Are you on track to achieve your goals? Call me the proverbial naysayer here, but I would bet that most will miss out on achieving goals, and most that do miss the mark probably will do so because of poor or no planning. Actually, that's the problem when franchisees and franchisors are faced with succession issues or when there's serious thought to selling their business. My guest today is Bruce Schaefer. Bruce is the founder and president of Franchise Valuation Limited, a company specializing in valuations and appraisals, succession planning, and estate planning exclusively for the franchise community. In this first segment of our two-part franchise financial series, Bruce and I will discuss succession planning for both franchisee and franchisor, as well as business valuation, a topic that many business owners, large and small, know little or nothing about, or don't really want to know, which, of course, is part of the head-in-the-sand syndrome. And we know what happens when one's head is in the sand. Your most vulnerable asset is exposed for all the world to see. Then in next week's second part of the series, co-producer Joe Caruso brings another brilliant mind in franchising to the party, David Pearl. David's a CPA and a business financial consultant at Pearl Business Group, as well as the former chief financial officer at eBrands Restaurants and Sonny's Franchise Company. Next week's show is titled, How to Use Financial Metrics as an Essential Franchise Management Tool. You can't fix what you can't see. And our discussion will target cash management for franchise companies, financial performance metrics, franchise reporting and analysis, and mergers and acquisitions. So as you can tell, Joe has put together a fabulous 1-2 punch in franchise financial issues. Well, before getting to the meat of today's segment, let's take a look at some of the happenings in and around the IFA that we refer to as the IFA Corner. The election season recently ended after nearly 2 years of campaigning to get out the vote for franchise-friendly candidates. IFA's Franchise Congress Network was extremely active in local, state, and federal elections, and 85% of IFA-supported candidates were victorious in their races. Many Franchise Congress members covered shifts so their employees could vote. Others provided extra time off so their employees could get to the polls. These Franchise Congress leaders volunteered at their local polling locations and phone banks and made a difference this election season. For details on the Franchise Congress program, please contact IFA Advocacy Director Meredith Nethercutt. For individuals interested in the Certified Franchise Executive Program, limited time remains to apply for the IFA Educational Foundation's Certified Franchise Executive Scholarship Program. The IRL Marshall CFE Scholarship Award includes a $2,500 stipend, which can be applied toward the tuition for programs offered for CFE credit and complimentary IFA annual convention registration. Applications must be received by November 30th. And as today is Veterans Day, it's only fitting to mention if your franchise is not already doing so, I encourage you to participate in IFA's Veterans Transition Franchise Initiative Program, known as VetFran, and help honorably discharged veterans transition to civilian careers. Nearly 400 IFA member companies voluntarily participate and offer financial incentives, typically in the way of a discount on the initial franchise fee. Nearly 1,800 veterans have purchased franchises since the program was relaunched in 2002. So please, please do your part to help former U.S. military personnel pursue the dream of small business ownership. For more information, please visit the IFA website at www.franchise.org. And as we continue to creep up on the IFA convention in Las Vegas, I feel compelled to remind you to make plans to attend. So if you haven't already registered, please visit Franchise Essentials site at www.fmdpro.com, where you'll find the IFA 2011 logo. Click on the logo, and it'll take you directly to the IFA convention registration page. And as a wrap-up to the IFA corner, I'd like to remind everyone that as we come back from the Thanksgiving holiday, my guest on Thursday, December 2nd, will be Elisa Harrison. As most within franchising are aware, Elise is the Vice President of Communications and Marketing at the International Franchise Association. Elise and I will discuss the upcoming IFA convention, other IFA events, and an overview of the new leadership at the IFA, and basically an update on all things IFA. Well, as I mentioned before, my guest today is Bruce Schaefer. Bruce is one of the leading experts in franchise succession planning and business valuation. His firm, Franchise Valuations Limited, is exclusive to franchising. Bruce has been a speaker for the NYU Institute on Federal Taxation, the Practicing Law Institute, the International Franchise Association, and many other business, professional, and academic forums. Bruce, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, it's great having you, and certainly succession planning is very important for franchisees and franchisors and, of course, small business owners everywhere, as well as business valuation. So as I know, it's definitely a hot topic of interest to our listening audience. Let's just dive right in. So why is succession planning important for franchisees and franchisors? And the second part is, what happens if people fail to plan for the eventual sale of their business? Let's take the first question.
Okay, why is it important? Let's revert to your prior analogy of a Y2K. You said people respond to a threat. Realistically, the sword of Damocles threat that should motivate all business owners, in particular franchisees, is, as the doctor says, none of us are getting out of here alive. So ultimately, one way or another, death is the threat. Now, because people don't like to infuse themselves with that kind of pessimism, at least in my practice, I find a lot of people, again, to go to your ostrich analogy, really don't like to address it simply because it's their own mortality. They're uncomfortable with it. I've never met anyone that was particularly happy about discussing their own demise. But whether you like it or not, from a prudent point of view, considering that generally in the franchisee context, the ownership of that franchise makes up 50, 70, sometimes 80% of all the assets. It's really something that has to be planned for. Otherwise, people are being beyond imprudent. I mean, it's more than sloppy. It's kind of cruel to the estate that you've worked so hard to put together. So even if the succession planning is not occasioned by death, but by some other triggering event, like you want to sell and go play golf, there really should be a plan from the beginning, because, again, it is such a high value and generally high percentage of total value asset with respect to people's overall net worth that are involved in franchising.
Now, what are, when we hear about succession planning, of course, you know, you're right on, you're the expert. I mean, no, people don't want to address it because they don't want to address their own mortality. But I know there are some things that need to be done. What are a couple of the areas of succession planning that you can point out that they need to be aware of?
Well, in general, people need to have certain estate planning documents that relate to anything, be it a business asset or your pinky ring. So people must know that they must have a will in many situations where there's a substantial estate. There's a use of what is called a revocable trust or a living trust, or it has many names, but it's not a tax savings tool, but it does save people money by, for example, avoiding probate. It also assures privacy, and it effectuates a very immediate transfer upon death, whereas a will sometimes requires probate, which may take a certain amount of time. So in all events, certain estate planning documents are necessary, but where a franchise is concerned, particularly a franchisee's ownership of a franchise, sometimes what the franchisee may write in their will or their trust will be of no moment, because the asset itself is what the law calls a contract right. It's not the same as ownership of the back 40 acres of a ranch that's outright and in what is called fee simple. This is a contract right, the ownership, the transfer, the termination of which is subject to the terms of the contract itself. And as you and I'm sure your audience know, if you've ever seen a franchise agreement, it goes on and on about what is an allowable transfer, what is not an allowable transfer, and some of the provisions that you find almost universally are things like a right of approval, a mandated process for the franchisor to supervise any transfer. Sometimes there's a right of first refusal. All these things come into play. So simply saying in your will, I leave my franchise to my son, Johnny, when, for example, he hasn't been trained in whatever hamburger university or equivalent there is in this particular franchise, it's going to be what is called precatory language or a suggestion at best, and it's not going to be anything that can be imposed on the franchisor, and if they don't like your plan, it's just too bad. So if you fail to plan for almost any asset, you're causing your heirs or successors a lot of difficulty. But if it's a franchise that you don't plan for, you could very well end up forcing a distress sale and terribly damaging the value of this asset and losing its value for your family, and a whole lot of consequences that come with an asset like a franchise for which there really does have to be specific and very well-informed planning before you do anything else.
Absolutely. I mean, we know there's a uniqueness of selling a going concern franchise business, which certainly can complicate the transaction. I mean, as you were talking, I was thinking of all the things when you said that if it went into probate, it could really delay. And I'm thinking, well, what happens to the business during that delay period of time? Who's operating it? Who's going to training? Who's handling day-to-day? Who's monitoring customer service? The responsibilities that the franchisors have to other franchisees in the area to make sure the brand is not damaged during that interim. And, of course, nobody wants to see it shuttered even temporarily. And, of course, as you said, distress sale definitely could be an end result. So there's really a host of things that definitely come to mind. You know, and something that I've been passionate about in working with small business owners outside the realm of franchising, and I call it visionary succession planning, basically what would Pop do? And too many times the owner of the business is so entrenched in the day-to-day business, and they, in essence, are the business. And too often, as you said, Johnny, you know, inherits the business, and Johnny may have an MBA from Harvard, and he may have been in corporate America for 10 years and certainly is well-educated and well-versed in business practices. But at the end of the day, as we all know, operating a small business is sometimes very unique, having to wear so many different hats. And there are things that are very inherent to the way Pop ran the business, and as I like to term, what would Pop do? So, yes, I mean, there are a lot of things to consider. So when should a business owner actually begin to think about succession plan and then, of course, you know, their exit strategy?
Well, there's a short answer for that, which is basically the first minute you get it, because I generally give clients the analogy of how do you know you're not going to step off the curb and get hit by the bus today. So there should be a plan in place, because death is not always something that, you know, leaves specific dates in advance as to when it's going to occur. Beside that, if one looks at this this big, usually more than majority investment of assets in a franchise, one should treat it financially and strategically the same way any prudent investor would look at an investment, and that is to come in, to operate, and to have an exit strategy. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to implement the exit strategy. If, for example, you've got a 10-year term and three 10-year renewals, you may choose to plan to get out at the end of the first 10. And when that comes, you may say, damn, this has been such a happy time and it's been profitable. I don't think I'm leaving right now. And so you modify your plan. These plans are what the law calls ambulatory instruments. It's the same thing that is used as a description for a will. It's ambulatory, meaning that it's walking. It only becomes permanent, like in musical chairs, when the music stops and there's only that number of chairs. Well, that's when a will becomes effective, is when you drop dead. And up until then, you can change it, and it's as ambulatory as anything. And your succession plan for your business should have the same level of flexibility. You should be able to change it if, you know, you want to disinherit that terrible son-in-law, or for whatever reason, there should always be not only prudent financial planning involved, but there should be an enormous amount of flexibility, because stuff happens, and anybody who tells you that they have a perfect plan that works in all instances is being a fool. And I just want to get back to one other thing, which you sort of extended the comment on the need for the succession plan and, you know, the financial damage that could be occasioned by its absence. But this is an area where, regrettably, franchisors and franchisees, in my experience, which is many years, have looked at each other in an adversarial manner, in large part. And if you look at it from pure self-interest and economic interest here, in fact, there's nothing adversarial about this transfer process. It should be seamless on behalf of both the franchisor and the franchisee. The last thing the franchisee wants is damage to this very valuable asset, which, again, makes up an enormous percentage of the estate. The last thing the franchisor wants is a lousy operation that's going to give a bad name to its system, or an operation that starts to do poorly and cuts off its royalty stream. I mean, for every selfish economic reason that is available, you know, which you could boil down to greed or a desire for a fair or good return on your investment, both of them share the same values and the same interests. So I've been saying for many years and have been ignored that franchisors really should put on clinics on succession planning for their franchisees because of this very fact that they both share the same self-interest that any succession be as seamless as possible because it only benefits both parties, and when it's not, it harms both parties.
Absolutely. Now, with that in mind, is it prudent to share your succession plan with the franchisor, obviously ahead of time when the succession plan is actually put into place and developed?
Well, it's more than prudent, and I would say if you don't, you're a damn fool, because, again, if you go back and look at a franchise agreement and all the provisions that relate to allowability of transfer and approval of the transferee, suppose it's to your family. You want to get it clear and cleared by the franchisor before you come up with a great plan that they won't allow. Let me give you a real-life example. One of the first I ran into, and this is in the 1980s, I had a very successful franchisee with 4 units and 6 kids. And the franchises, which have golden arches, will not be named. And what they had in their very well-known restriction provisions on transfer was that they did not allow plural ownership. And considering them as absolutely the most successful franchise operation in history, clearly their prohibition on plural ownership had nothing to do with being mean or selfish or anything like that. As a pure business decision, after many years, they had found that when there are partners, there are more damn fights than it's worth, and they don't like it. They allow husbands and wives, and they don't allow brothers and sisters. You may think it's foolish, but it's very hard to argue with the kind of success they've had. So here I am confronted with a man with 4 units, 6 children, and such a severe heart condition that he's uninsurable. So there's no way to basically replace the value of the franchises, and there's no way to equally distribute them among the kids. So when I walk in with my great plan to put everything in a trust and equalize it for the benefit of all 6 kids, you know, you can take that stroke of genius and flush it down the toilet, because it's only a stroke of genius in your mind, and it won't be allowed at the level of the real world. So do you want to clear it with the franchisor? My lord, absolutely yes.
You know, you took a thought right out of my mind, because I was thinking about the potential complications with partners in a succession plan. That's a very good point. But, you know, a lot of times, as you said, a lot of people don't want to face their own mortality. And, of course, when we hear succession planning, we do immediately think of death and wills and estates and what have you. But couldn't succession planning also be an integral part of the planning process in case of a debilitating injury that might leave the franchisee incapable of operating their business, even if it's for a temporary period of time? How does that all play into it?
Well, surely. In succession or estate planning, we refer to this as the three Ds, which should be planned for: death, disability, and disaffection if you have partners. So absolutely, a succession plan is something more than, okay, Joey gets it, signed Willie. Obviously, there's a great deal of thought that has to go into this. There are many, many documents that have to be planned for, drafted, prepared, executed. If, as you mentioned, you have partners, well, now you have to have a partnership agreement or a corporate buy-sell agreement. You have to have a provision therein that accounts for the same three Ds: what happens if one partner dies, what happens if two just can't stand working with the third anymore. All of these things should be planned for in advance, because certainly at the estate planning or succession planning level, experience shows that it happens. It may not happen in every business or every enterprise that there's discord, but it sure happens enough to keep an awful lot of lawyers busy full-time for the past couple of hundred years. So you know that it's a potential. You don't know what its probability is, but if you fail to plan for it, as Coach Wooden says, you know, failing to plan is planning to fail. So you certainly will have it blow up in your face if you don't address these, unless you're very lucky. And if you're very lucky, then, you know, why bother with any of this? But if you're prudent, if, for example, you have, you know, children or a spouse that you're planning for, then, you know, the level of your duty to be prudent rises, and the methods for accomplishing that are pretty well known, but they're not cookie cutter and they're not that simplistic. And again, in the franchise context, there's the added layer of the transfer itself that becomes problematic, because it's a contract right, not an outright owned asset.
I mean, it certainly raises a bunch of interesting questions in my mind, having sat in the seat of franchisor, because I immediately think, okay, you know, there's a succession plan in place. One of the partners passes on. His part of the business goes to Johnny, as you said. And then all of a sudden, you know, Johnny and the other partner don't get along. I mean, it's almost like a domino effect. If anybody is out there running their business right now and doesn't have a plan in place, I hope this definitely motivates them to begin taking some action. And as you talk about, you know, of course, you know, franchise is a unique asset. We talk about the uniqueness of selling that going concern franchise business, which, of course, can complicate a transaction. Let's talk a minute about, you know, when it does come time to sell. You know, what happens when a franchisee seller has a letter of intent or an asset purchase agreement with a prospective buyer, and the franchisor thinks the sales price is too high, or there's some other circumstance or factor in the transaction that the franchisor disagrees with?
then it's tough darts for the franchisee, unless the franchisor is being what the law would call arbitrary and capricious. If they have a business reason, whether the franchisee agrees with it or not, if they have a reasonable cause, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a good cause, to deny the transfer, then they certainly may do so. I will give you my experience in this, and it's decades. When I started in the early 80s in this, nobody ever heard of a franchisor denying a transfer because the price was too high, because it enhanced the rumors, it enhanced the anecdotes that were strewn about the system, about how much your unit appreciated. It made more potential franchisees want to buy in. It was thought to be, you know, a great thing. You buy at 10, you sell at 25, real good. Then I would guess toward the end of the 90s, for the first time, I started seeing situations where franchisors said to franchisees, "I'm sorry, we're not going to approve that. The price is too high." And if it seems counterintuitive, you have to look at it from the franchisor's point of view, because they know the real economics of the unit. And they know that if this guy is paying this much, he's overpaying. And they know that he's going to be the one that they're in bed with for the next 20 years under the new franchise agreement. And he's going to be bitching at them for all 20 years because his return on investment is going to be garbage because he overpaid, and the franchisor knows it. So from their point of view, in terms of a happy franchisee community and not having to deal with what normally happens to people that overpay, which is that they go out of business, the franchisor is being not, again, mean-spirited or foolish, but being prudent from a business point of view. In fact, one could clearly argue that's what they're supposed to do. That's certainly what their shareholders would think. They don't benefit from, you know, this overpriced aspect of the transfer consideration. So all they do, in fact, is suffer the whining and the pain of the one who overpays. So the economics have been sort of, you know, pendulum-like in the way they've gone from you can't get enough to now, gee, I don't know, that's way too much. And they both made sense at the time they were implemented, and I guess the situation now with we have to be careful, especially in these economic times, I think it is sensible from the franchise system-wide point of view whether a particular franchisee is angered by a failure to approve a price or not.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the word pendulum, and immediately my thoughts raced to Edgar Allan Poe's The Pit and the Pendulum, and all of a sudden I saw franchisee and franchisor on either side and saw this big open pit down below, and it was just this image that just ran through my mind. You know, I hear what you're saying. So, you know, I guess the thing to do is really be able to evaluate a fair market value for the business, so and get the franchisor involved from a franchisee's perspective, so that, you know, whatever price does come up at that point, at least that's a starting point. So with that in mind, how does a franchisee determine a fair market value for their business?
Well, just let me preface this with, again, unique to franchises and certain other intangible assets, the first level of planning here has to be the permission to transfer itself. So that's where your previous questions about should you consult with the franchisor becomes, you know, an even more mandatory yes. Now, your question, if I understand you, is how do you value the franchise?
Yeah, how do you place a value on your franchise business? How does a franchisee determine that fair market value for their business and as a franchise, so that when they do put it up for sale and they do get a letter of intent or an asset purchase agreement and they're using this fair market value as that baseline, which I would think they would already discuss with the franchisor, that would eliminate a sales price being too high. So with all that in mind, how does a franchisee determine that fair market value?
Well, there's the conceptual way that the law looks at it, and fair market value is a term of art that derives from the tax law that goes back to the 1930s. And then there's the real world aspect of how they do it, which is sometimes a rule of thumb, which may or may not have a logical basis, or is, you know, because somebody's brother-in-law said so. Sometimes price estimates are determined by what I call country club advice. You know, what did you pay for that advice? Because that's what it's worth. Now, as far as the technical legal definition of fair market value, again, it comes from the gift and estate tax area. And it's based on a hypothetical buyer and seller, neither under compulsion, both in full possession of the facts, and having the ability to either take or not take. And again, they're hypothetical. Now, within that context, and there's a revenue ruling, number 59-60, that is sort of the great grandfather of all of the considerations that go into a determination of fair market value, including things like the general economic climate, the specific area of the economy that the business enterprise is involved in, the competence or incompetence of management, labor situations, seasonality, book value, dividend-paying capacity, a whole host of considerations that a savvy financial person would take into account. Now, it may very well be that the actual sale is determined to some immigrant couple that simply said, we'll pay you 80% of the revenues, and that's how the price was determined, and nobody went into any economic evaluation or anything like that. But for purposes of business planning, tax planning, succession planning, you have to come up with a fair market valuation, whether or not that's what you obtain in the real world. And a fair market valuation has three basically permissible methods that can be used. The lawyers call them book value, capitalization of earnings, and comparable sales. The accountants call basically the same three methods cost, income, and market. They are the same. The same two sets of names for the same three methods. The underlying arithmetic that goes with the methods, I will give you a brief description of. Book value or cost is basically just what it says. It is the book value, except that for valuation purpose, if it's, for example, depreciated real estate, you would look at the replacement cost, not the depreciated cost carried on the books to determine the value. So book value will give you a certain valuation, but is rarely, if ever, useful in the franchise context, because most franchise companies, statistics show, and I did this a couple of years ago for an American Bar Association article, but the value of most franchise companies is made up 70 to 80% of intangibles. And one of the rules of accounting is that self-created intangibles do not appear on your books. So basically, an asset that constitutes more than a supermajority, I mean 75, 80% of your business, does not appear on your books. By definition, your business, using a book value method, is going to be undervalued. So you're obligated as a valuation specialist to look at that method and basically say, man, this is a stupid method for this particular asset, so I better go and move on to the next method. The next method is called the income method, or the capitalization of earnings. It's a price-earnings ratio of 20 to 1 is a 5% capitalization of earnings rate. It simply means that under some theories, the value of a business today is the current discounted value of all its earnings into the future, a concept called net present value. So it's there's an old cartoon line about, I'll happily pay you tomorrow for a hamburger that you'll give me today, and that's sort of the concept of present discounted value. The right to get paid in 10 years from now, $100, is not worth the right to have $100 in your fist today. It's worth, in fact, probably about half. So a method like that, and the courts generally refer to it as a discounted cash flow method, takes into account the cash flow or the profits of a business for a period certain, and then estimates a value at the end of that term, which is called a terminal value, which when I first started in this, I was a very novice guy and thought it had something to do with cancer because it was terminal value, but it really has nothing to do with that. It's just a future projection of a venture capital investor's price that he would get out at that time. So the discounted cash flow adds up the present value of the profits for the period certain, and then on top of that puts the terminal value, again, discounted to present value, which would be received at the end of that term, adds the two together, and that's your second methodology for estimating or opining or appraising as to the value of an enterprise. The third method is what are called comparable sales by lawyers or market by accountants. And that's basically, let's go out in the street and see what this is selling for, if it is what is called a open quotes comparable close quote asset. Now, the law makes it pretty clear that an asset really has to be quite comparable to be acceptable as a comparable value for purposes of fixing the value of a similar asset. However, in franchising, it's not that hard to come by because there is enormous uniformity in franchising. It's one of the secrets of the success of the concept. And so the selling price of one franchise within a system, or of 30 franchises preferably within a system, should be very indicative of the fair market value of the one that you're estimating. And in fact, there's a recent ruling of the Financial Accounting Standards Board that says we would very much prefer comparable sales as the method to be used over any of the others. And if such information is available, it should probably be controlling, unless you've got a damn good reason why it shouldn't be. So if, for example, you can go online and see that a certain franchise system's resales are listed, and they list enough data so that you can see that their resale asking price, I don't know what their obtaining price is, but their asking price is roughly 36 cents on the dollar of revenues, then you can at least fairly opine that comparable units, if you're in the same system, are selling for 36, and then you can adjust that value saying, but this particular unit has a wonderful lease, and so it should be given a premium value because, you know, it's way under market for the rent, and it makes it more profitable than it should be. Or, on the other hand, it has a terrible labor situation, it has to pay three times as much. Or, as you regularly see in franchise prospectuses, open per rent, except in New York City, where it's 300% of this estimate, closed per rent. So you have to adjust your values that way. So now I've given you the three methods for valuing the enterprise on a gross basis, and then you have to either apply control premiums or some sorts of discounts. And it's rare that a franchisee would be entitled to a premium, but you may very well, as a professional valuation person, be obligated to take discounts if, for example, there is a right of first refusal. The tax court has ruled that it certainly is a discount, pretty much like Potter Stewart said with pornography, I know it when I see it. So the tax court ruled, we know it's a discount, but we don't know how much. You know, you'll have to come back to us on an individual case-by-case basis. But it may be as much as 15%, they said. I personally don't think that it's entitled to that much. But then you run into situations, and if you want me to shut up, you'll tell me, where you may be looking to discount the value because for tax purposes, you want a lower value. So in situations like that, planners use vehicles like family limited partnerships or LLCs and then take further discounts, not only for the right of first refusal or the right of approval, but then at the entity level itself for lack of marketability, for a minority discount, and in terms of legitimately saving taxes on the transfer, either gift or estate taxes, it's not that difficult to accomplish 50% discounts on what would otherwise be the enterprise value and thereby save very substantial transfer taxes on that asset.
Well, I mean, as you were talking, I mean, I had unbelievable interest in this, and it really piqued so many different questions in my mind, and I have to agree with you wholeheartedly. You said franchisors should be conducting succession planning for, you know, modules online or webinars or seminars or whatever for franchisees, because I would say the majority of franchisees out there don't have a clue, and I definitely see why it's beneficial for franchisors to help facilitate succession planning for their franchisees.
Let me interrupt you for 1 second and explain why it's been so adversarial and why the franchisors have practiced sort of studious avoidance. It's because when you get to the point where, as a franchisor, you put on a succession planning seminar for your franchisees, one of the first, if not the first all-time issue that comes up is, well, we have an estate tax problem, and the estate tax is levied on the value of the franchise. And what's the value of the franchise, Mr. Franchisor? Because you guys know, because you approve all the transfers, so you're the repository of all the information on comparable sales. Would you please share that with us? And the answer has generally been, not a damn chance. So that's where the hostility to what should otherwise be a real, I hate to use the word partnership, in the franchise context, but an action that the people do have common interest, but nobody seems to want to open the checkbook, you know?
Yeah, that that raised a few more questions in my mind. And we've got 10 minutes to the end of the hour, and I've got to say, and I know Joe Caruso feels the same way. Bruce, we're going to need to bring you back in the future because we really need to dive into this. But, you know, over these next few minutes, let's just shift gears a bit because I know we have a lot of franchisors listening and will be listening on demand over the weekend. Give us, you know, maybe just a couple of pointers that you think reflect franchisor succession planning best practices.
Well, franchisors, from my experience, are usually not as closely held as franchisees. So, you know, in large part, they're public companies. And so the succession plan is really a management succession plan within the franchisor. And it's... you know, it's not within the same criteria that you would have. If it's a closely held franchisor, there are certain success problems that should be looked at. For example, sometimes a closely held franchisor can be what the tax law calls a personal holding company, and that's like a penalty tax. Sometimes a closely held franchisor will be paying its owners a tremendous amount of money and calling it compensation. And there's another tax issue called reasonable compensation, where they may come back in and tax the company. Sometimes companies would prefer to keep money within the company rather than distributing it. And there's another penalty tax called an accumulated earnings tax that is sometimes levied against what the IRS considers incorporated pocketbooks. And this could, you know, these sorts of situations arise in successful, closely held franchise companies. It used to be a big issue for the International Franchise Association. In fact, in the late 80s, they had a committee I was on called the FAT Committee, in part because of the size of my belly and in part because it stood for finance, accounting, and tax. And at that time, the IRS was, for some reason, investigating several closely held franchisors, in particular for personal holding company taxes. So you probably want to do more income tax and financial tax planning for a franchisor, at least in my experience, than you do for succession planning. Because, again, most of the substantial ones are either public or operated by very sophisticated financial entities.
That's definitely an interesting thought. And I know a lot of franchisors out there are going to be shaking their head right now trying to figure out their next steps. And, you know, a lot of times, as we know, you get a startup franchisor, they have some quick growth, they become classified as an emerging franchisor, and of course, they feel the value of their company goes up considerably. And then, of course, you know, there are others, you know, whether it be, you know, venture capital groups or others that might invest or want to actually purchase the company. And we talk about, just a minute ago, about the various valuation methods for franchisees. How are franchise company valuations determined?
Okay, well, you make an interesting point that should be expanded when you say certain franchise companies have substantial growth. The commonplace and the big money preference method for valuing franchisor companies is usually a multiple of EBITDA. EBITDA stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. It's supposed to be some sort of close estimate of cash flow. Now, if you're a franchise company and you have substantial growth, and I've been involved with some that have gone from 20 to 200 within a year and a half, and then grown substantially from there, if you allow someone to value your company on a multiple of EBITDA, well, first off, you're crazy, and second off, you want to make sure that the multiple of EBITDA you get takes into account the growth that's going to take place in the EBITDA number. So it's not just the multiple number, it's how badly you would be cheating yourself by using a current EBITDA number when you know for a fact, or at least assume, that it's going to be double, triple, perhaps six, I've seen 15 and 20 times next year what it is this year. So as a startup franchisor, either bringing in capital or selling out, that growth factor is an enormous calculation factor that you have to take into account. And if you're going to do your valuation estimate on this, I mean, you have to understand that EBITDA is a sort of ancillary or corollary of the cash flow method, and basically it assumes a static cash flow, and for a growth company you're going to assume anything but. So you want your estimates and your calculations to take into account this tremendous growth, because otherwise you're screwing yourself terribly.
Sure. I mean, and I'm looking at the time, and we are going to be running out of time, and I've got a host of questions that I still have. I'd love to have you on the show again, maybe after the holidays, if you can fit it into your schedule, because I know, you know, there are Bush tax cuts to talk about. There's other aspects of a franchisor selling their business. There's tax nexus. Some that came out of my mind as we were talking about business valuation and thinking about, you know, the franchisees that are out there, you know, facing bankruptcy and valuation issues that they have to deal with there. So I really would hope that you'd be coming on our show again after the first of the year. If, like I said, if you can fit it into your schedule, I know Joe and I would greatly appreciate it, and I know our franchise listeners would greatly appreciate it.
Sure thing. We should all live and be well.
Right. Well, thank you for very, very much for being my guest today. As I said, having you back. I'd also like to thank co-producer Joe Caruso for putting together another informative segment of Franchise Today. You can listen to this segment on demand at www.blogtalkradio.com/Franchise Today Show. All the shows are archived there. This one will be available within an hour after this show. Remember, next week my guest is David Pearl as we continue our franchise financial series. Franchise Today will take the week off, but we'll be back on the air the following week with the IFA's Lisa Harrison as my guest. Thank you again to Bruce Schaefer. So until next week, I'm Paul Segretto, wishing you the best in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.